So let's...
She went to get you one.
That's terrific. I appreciate that, sir. Sure. So let's go ahead and open with the Lord's Prayer, taking a moment of silence for the compulsive eater, bulimic, or anorexic who's suffering either in this room or outside it, and we know they are out there. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I will let mine be done. And again, my name is Sheila. I'm a compulsive overeater. Hi, guys. Very, very grateful to be here. Thank you for having me. And how this is going to go. This is going to take about 3 hours. We're going to do a break right in the middle. And obviously, if you get up at will and get drinks, go to the bathroom, do whatever you'd like. If you need to chat or text or do anything, I would just ask you to go outside for no other reason but that I'm very easily distracted. And we'll be depending on you when I do get distracted and head into segue stories and things like that. So that's the big reason. But how it's going to go is so we'll do a break about halfway through. We'll do a 10-minute break. It's always my intention to start on time and end on time because I really honor the fact that it's a beautiful Saturday afternoon and you've already been here and it's a wonderful thing and I thank you for being here and showing up on time, but I do honor your time. So we'll make sure that we close at 4:30. So we'll have a break about an hour and a half, 10-minute break, and I'm going to share my story. That'll take about a half an hour. Then I'm going to tell you, this is a sponsoring chronic slippers workshop, and I'll tell you all about that in terms of why I started doing this and what it was all about. And I'm going to spend about 40 minutes, I guess. Thank you so much. Sure. 40, 45 minutes talking about what I very specifically do with chronic slippers. And I was a chronic slipper myself, and you'll hear that when I get into my story. And then then we'll take our break, and then in the last step, we'll do like 40, 45 minutes or 50 minutes on the Big Book, because I sponsor people exclusively from the Big Book. And I love OA literature. I love the AA 12 and 12, quite frankly, but I only sponsor people from the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't take long. It only takes a couple of months to take people through those steps. But it's just been from my own personal experience and from the experience I've had in working with slippers, both in this program and in the Mother program, because I'm 24 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, that this is the most effective way to try and create that situation for somebody where they literally have that transformation that it talks about in the book, and somebody never has to return to the eating if you don't want to. I mean, you have to work really, really hard. If you've really worked those steps thoroughly and you've been guided and directed through those steps and you do what they suggest, and I say that in quotation marks because the truth is there are 92 musts in the first 164 pages of the Big Book, right? We're given a lot of direction. I mean, that's just the good news. It's the good news if you're done. It's the bad news if you're not. But the truth is you can call them suggestions if you want, but... You know, it's like if you fall in a pool and you don't know how to swim, I suggest you start moving your arms and your legs. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just, you know. So, you know, and Bill kind of did it with a wink and a smile, too. And we're going to talk about the original, how it works and how it was, because Bill had written, you know, everything other than the doctor's opinion, everything from Bill's story to the end of, the last chapter. Bill did all that writing except what we read and how it works. From the rarely have we seen a person fail to the bottom of the ABC. In that portion of the book, the first 100 people, the 99 men and the one woman, weighed in with Bill and they said, look, you can't, because Bill had a very, very directed how it works. It was very, very directed. And they said, you know, Bill, I don't think alcoholics are going to respond well to that. So, you know, I think we need to lighten up a little bit. And Bill very, very, at the time, right, in 35, very, very reluctantly agreed. Well, not 35. The book came out in 39, so they were writing it in those 4 years. But he very, very reluctantly went along. He later said in different grapevine writings and letters and things that, you know, he was glad that he let them weigh in and make that change. But the truth is, if one were to read the Big Book from the beginning of Bill's story to page 164, sociologically, you can see that there is a change in those three pages. They are much softer and gentler and sweeter, whereas throughout the rest of the book, there's a lot of direction and there's a lot of you need to do this. And quite frankly, if you want what we have, it's time for a change. So he's pretty candid about that. He's pretty clear about that. But so that's how it's going to go, and then we're going to leave about a half an hour. So like from 4 to 4:30, in case people want to duck out at 4, you want to split. But we're going to do a Q&A, and that would just be where I'm sharing from my experience or, you know, giving you my 2 cents. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right, very good. So, my name is Sheila, and I, again, am a compulsive overeater. And I'm very, very grateful to be here. And I have been abstinent in Overeaters Anonymous. I just celebrated 12 years, so my abstinence date is May 30th, 2000. And I've been in Overeaters Anonymous for 24 years, so that lets you know, right? I was a chronic slipper here for about a dozen years. And I have an incredible problem with sugar. I had an amazingly insane problem with sugar. And I started stealing sugar when I was about 4 years old. So we had a close family friend who was a grocer. And I remember he used to, he would give me candy, he would give me Milky Way candy bars, he'd give me whatever I wanted. That was my drug of choice, or drug of no choice, right? Because quite frankly, right, sugar is my drug of no choice, right? Because when I eat it, I have no more choice about where we're going from there, right? you know, for me, eating sugar is like dancing with a gorilla, right? You're done when the gorilla says you're done. You know what I mean? So I just don't, I just have no choice around sugar. And I had a horrendous, horrendous problem with sugar. So this guy, this grocer, would give me candy bars in exchange for wet kisses. I remember his lips were always wet. Very inappropriate. He was like a 45-year-old man. It was gross. And I can remember the day, again, I was 4 years old, I can remember the day when I just thought, well, I'm just going to start stealing these because this is just not okay, right? And I'm probably an incest survivor. I probably am. I don't have any conscious memories, but when I went through puberty, I had kind of the classic problems that, you know, a young woman or a young man has if you've been molested. There were huge, huge emotional problems, not just your average, you know, I'm going through puberty having those problems, but inordinate amount of problems. And my oldest brother, the one who's deceased, and we'll talk about him, he died of diabetes. He had molested my oldest sister. I'm the youngest of five. Again, my oldest brother's deceased, so there are four surviving now. But he had molested my oldest sister, and then that grocer that I mentioned, and there was another, he had a family friend, he had a friend that was also a family friend of ours. And I spent a lot of alone time with those two different men when I was like 10 years old, driving around in the back of their Buick. Like, I don't know what that was about, right? So I certainly have all the characteristics, so probably was. And that'll, we'll get back to that when I start talking about the steps in the big book and stuff and how it's possible to clean that up and get free of that kind of stuff, that kind of resentment and anger and pain and anxiety. But so I started stealing candy, and stealing was a big, big part of my story. It was a huge, huge part of my story. I did a lot of, you know, I would always blow through my Halloween candy by about, you know, the 3rd or 4th of November, and then I would start in on my siblings, and then I had two best friends who were twins, who were thin. You know, they're the kind of girls who would still have Halloween candy at Easter. It's like, are you kidding me? You know, what? What? How did I not know about that, right? That was the bigger question, not how do you still have it, but how did I not get into that, right? When I was spending the night at your house. But so I was always getting into other people's stuff, and then when I got into to high school, let me stay a little bit more. When I was 7 years old, so again, 4 years old, that stuff with the grocer, started stealing sugar, and so again, I had a raging problem with sugar, right? Well, when I was 7 years old, my oldest brother, who was 7 years older than me, got diabetes, juvenile onset. He was 15. And all the sugar, my parents were, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. We were kind of lower middle class. My father had gone to school on the GI Bill. My mother had a high school education. And they didn't know what to do, fairly unsophisticated people. So all the sugar disappeared from our house, right? Because, well, I've got a diabetic kid, so let's get rid of all the sugar in our house. Well, we got a problem now because you've got an addict, right? You got a little sugar addict in the house, and now there's no more sugar in the house, right? So that's what kind of fueled the, well, let me blow through my Halloween candy, then let me blow through yours, and, you know, I stole candy from the catechism teacher and stuff. I mean, it was just, I was always doing wacky stuff because I had to get my hands on sugar. And I grew up in a crazy alcoholic home. And neither of my parents were alcoholics. My mother had an eating disorder, right? She was a compulsive overeater. And then my father ended up, probably my father in the end was probably anorexic because he kept getting thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner as he, you know, as he got older. And both my parents were unhappy people, died in their 60s, right? Mother also died of diabetes, but we'll talk about that when I get there. But I just had an incredible problem with sugar. So then I get to junior high, and I'm, you know, I have no idea to really gauge this until I went on my first diet in the ninth grade. I know my two friends were very thin, and then we had another friend that was even thinner, right? So everything was getting gauged based on those girls. But as I look back on it now and I look in pictures, I realize I was actually thin myself. I just wasn't as thin as them. So that's how it all got negated, right? But I was a cheerleader from 7th to 9th grade in junior high. And at the beginning, when I was in the 7th grade, I was the one that went on top, right? So I must have been small enough that I went on top. But by the time I was a cheerleader in 9th grade, I'd started menstruating, I was a base. Right? So I know, even the name is just horrible, right? So I was the one who was like leaning over while the little girls were now jumping on me, right? And then I got to high school and we had a very competitive squad, and the teacher or the coach she wasn't going to have fat girls on her cheerleading squad. So I really started putting on weight in high school, and again, had an incredible problem with sugar. And by the time I got to my senior year, so now I've really put on weight, and I'm guessing I probably weighed, I don't know, about 170 pounds. My top weight was 200 pounds. So I probably weighed 170 pounds, I'm guessing. And I know that I felt so embarrassed to be in pants that I wore dresses every single day. And I lied, and I told, because there were, you know, a couple all of a sudden high school boys, and they're like, why are you wearing dresses all the time, right? And I lied and said that my dad paid me to wear dresses. Well, my dad didn't pay me to wear dresses. I was just ashamed to be in pants, right? But I mean, so lying and deception is a huge part of it. Again, as a chronic slipper, we'll talk about this when we get there, but chronic slippers are two things. And I always tell people this when you call. Let me just, you know, let you know what you're in for here when we're doing this deal together. Chronic slippers are chronic liars and Susie, what's the other one I always say? We'll get there. Poor Susie. She gets schlepped to all my workshops. Chronic liars and I'll think of it. Don't worry, because it's me, right? It's not about you. It's about just me remembering who and what I am. But certainly chronic liars. And, I know, chronic victims, right? So there's chronic victimhood, right? So you're a chronic liar and you're a chronic victim. Don't you want to work with me, right? And they do. Who knows? At any rate, so the lying started, right? Because again, I lied and, you know, I wasn't going to let this guy kiss me anymore, so I started stealing. So there was just a lot of, you know, nefarious behavior that started early around my sugar consumption. And then I went to college, and it wasn't the freshman 15, it was like the 25 or the 30. And, you know, roommates got tired of me, and sweetmates, and people wanted me out because, again, I was always getting in your stuff. You know, it wasn't even like I was getting in their booze. You know, everybody else was like sneaking people's booze or sneaking their change. I was like sneaking their food, right? Their Cheez-Its and, you know, junk. All that awful stuff that you eat in college. And people just, you know, were getting tired of me. It was a real problem. And then I also kind of got introduced to drugs. I'd done a little bit of drinking in high school, but I was never anybody who held my liquor very well. So, you know, that didn't make for good drinking. And besides, I always say, if you would have lined up a bottle of tequila, a joint, now I was a good pot smoker, but a bottle of tequila, a joint, a line of cocaine, a carton of Marlboro Greens, and a hot fudge sundae, I would have run to the hot fudge sundae. I still would, like hands down. I always will say to my AA sponsor, you don't need to worry, I'm not going to drink again. Trust me, I'd rather have a hot fudge sundae, right? And that's starting, for starters. And then I'm going here and here and here, and here's what I'm going to have. And she said, well, don't be so sure. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I say, okay, well, whatever you say. But all I'm telling you is I'd much rather have a hot fudge sundae than a bottle of, you know, wine. That's all I'm telling you. But so I was now like my second and third year of college. And then, you know, time raced on because it took me 7 years to do a four-year undergraduate degree, right? And I never put two and two together about the time thing, right? But it took me a long time. And toward the end, I was pretty bad with the pot smoking. And I had some bad stuff happen. I was engaged to be married. My fiancé died of a cocaine overdose. You know, there were a lot of things that were trying to get my attention in terms of my substance abuse. And it just didn't, you know, it just didn't show up on my radar. But in my last term of school, I had, my dad had stopped paying for my education because I got a D in college, right? I'd gotten a couple of C's and he was really, you know, he was really not pleased with that. And as I'd said, you know, my father had his own business. He was mildly successful at one point and then it all kind of came tumbling down. But, you know, we didn't have money to burn. So he said, you know, I'm not paying for a D. Sorry, chickadee, you're on your own. So I had, you know, like a last term or two of school to pay for on my own. So while I'm in the food, in the sugar, in the, you know, the pot and stuff, I mean, it was not a recipe for success, that's for sure. And I had moved in with a woman who had a single mother who had three daughters, and they were like 8 to 10, right? 8, 9, and 10, I think they were. And I knew something bad was going to happen, and I was going to have this woman's kids in the car. I just knew it. Like, I got it. That intuition that it talks about on page 86, if we do the On Awakening, I knew something bad was going to happen with this woman's kids. And I didn't want that one on my life resume. That one I did not want, right? So I'd already totaled a car. I'd had the fiancé die. You know, I'd had myriad bad things already happening. I was ostracized from my family. There was a year of college that I lived in a house, you know, and 8 of us in a house, and they were all men, and I was, you know, the only woman in the house. I mean, I was gone, right? I was really, really gone emotionally and spiritually and physically, quite frankly. And, but I didn't want to kill somebody's kids, right? I figured if I got into an accident and I killed you and you'd made it to adulthood, well, you'd made it to adulthood, right? I figured if I killed myself, problem solved. I figured if I killed both of us, again, problem solved. But I didn't want to kill somebody's kids. So that got me motivated, so I went into my first meeting. And then I was there for about 3 months, right, in an AA meeting, and I turned to the woman next to me and I said, do you think you can have a problem with sugar like you have a problem with alcohol? And she said, absolutely. Here's where you go. Go to Overeaters Anonymous. So I came into Overeaters Anonymous in February of 1988, and I was really, really fortunate because I encountered a sponsor who changed my life, and what she said to me is something that I have done up to this point and that I do with all my sponsees, and that is that we work the steps regardless of whether you're in the food. I don't care. I always tell sponsees, I'm not that interested in what you eat. I'm very interested in that you do the work. That's the deal. Because if you're not doing the work, you're not going to be eating that way for long anyway, right? Abstinently, that is, right? So my sponsor said, I don't care if you've got Snickers bar in your left hand and a pen in your right hand. When you get to that four step, you're writing that four step. So, and I also, there are two schools of thought in Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course, both of them, right, because we're pig-headed alcoholics. Each side thinks they're right, the other one's absolutely insane and wrong, right? But there are two schools of thought. One says that you work through the steps one time. This was the group that was largely influenced by Bill and his New York people, that you go through the steps one time and then you're going to be working 10 through 12 for the rest of your life. And Dr. Bob, the Ohio cohort, was, no, just keep going through the steps, right? So you finish the steps and then you start going through them again. And, you know, yes, of course you're doing 10 through 12. Those are the maintenance steps, but you keep cycling through the steps. Well, again, being from Michigan, I was more influenced by that group. So the direction I also got is that you keep working the steps through them over and over again. So I did that both in Overeaters Anonymous and in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm also a member of Al-Anon, grateful member of Al-Anon. So I've done, you know, I'll be 25 years sober in November. I've done, you know, probably 34 steps maybe over their time in the, you know, various programs. And again, the direction I'd gotten, and I came, and it was funny because I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and I seemingly was doing it right, right? I came in, and not only did I stop drinking, but I stopped smoking pot, and I quit smoking cigarettes at the same time. And I remember being, you know, like the 3 months sober, and I was hanging out with a group of people who were about as sober as much as me, and we'd go to meetings together, and they were just climbing the walls. And I remember just thinking, right, as I'm in front of the donut plate, I'm just thinking, what's the big deal? What? Wow, you must not be as spiritual as me. Pass that cake, will you? Right? So, you know, that was my thing. So, and I don't at all discount the idea that I came in and got sober, right, and quit smoking cigarettes and quit smoking pot. That's huge. It's a huge deal. It's just food was always what I wanted. Food was my default, right? It was my thing. And it just made it easier to stop those things. But food was always my thing. So now I'm working the steps with a sponsor, and again, she had said to me, we're going to work the steps no matter what. And that was a real game changer for me, right? My top weight was, again, about 200 pounds. So my weight slowly started coming down. So within a year and a half, I'd lost 30 pounds. So now I'm like 170 pounds. And my dad had, and I came in, I was 24 years old. My dad had three overweight daughters, and he didn't like it. He didn't like having fat daughters. And he was very clear about that and would dialogue that with you in front of people. And I remember, so I'm now like a year absent in OA, and we were at some family event, and I know the outfit I was wearing because there's a picture of me in that outfit. And I walked out, and my dad, you know, turned around and said, wow, you've lost some weight, but you're not done, right? There's still weight. And I remember I turned around and I said, no more. You do not talk to me about my body anymore. It's over. And he never did, right? So that's how I know that working the steps, regardless of the fact that I wasn't conclusively out of the food, but I certainly wasn't out of the sugar, that's how I know it works, right? Because it's coming from my experience. Because that was an incredible thing, right? That's bigger than being a size whatever, is to be able to say to somebody who's been hassling you about your weight, knock it off. Especially to say it to your father. That's huge, right? Mm-hmm. So there are whole groups of people in this program and in some of the more structured food programs, people who want to have debates about whether or not you can work the steps when you're still in the food. I don't participate in those debates. I'm not going to participate in those debates with anybody. I'm not going to get in an argument with anybody in any 12-step program. We're crazy people, right? First of all, we don't fight fair, right? I'm not getting in a debate with anybody. But I'm especially not debating something that was not true from my experience. It just wasn't true. That just was not my experience. Not at all. It just wasn't, right? My life changed because I started working the steps and was still struggling with the food, right? So I kept doing that. I knew that that was the thing for me to do. So that's what I kept doing. Now, what happened with my chronic slipping is, despite the fact that I'm not a 100-pounder, right? Top weight's 200 pounds, haven't weighed 200 pounds since 1988. Despite the fact I'm not a 100-pounder, I've lost and gained, and it's more fun when I know the exact number, and I used to kind of keep track of it, but it's like 1,650-something pounds, right? And again, I'm not a 100-pounder. I mean, I do have a girlfriend in Overeaters Anonymous who's lost and gained 100 pounds about a dozen times, right? I know. Sad. It's sad the length she'll go to avoid feeling her feelings, because that's all it is. That's all it is. That's all that's going on. It's not a moral issue. Nobody's a bad girl. Nobody needs to have, a stricter sponsor or any of that nonsense. It's not any of that stuff. It's just somebody who's not willing to feel the feelings. That's all that's going on. That's it. But again, that's not my story. But my thing was that I would lose and gain 15, 20 pounds, about three times a year. Well, you gain and lose 15 pounds three times a year, that's 90 pounds, right? Remember, I've done this for a dozen years. That was my thing. And I've seen two registered dietitians who changed my life. One of them helped me when I was in the midst of all that. She's also a longtime member of Overeaters Anonymous, bulimic. And I was not bulimic, but she's bulimic. And she just helped me to stop hating myself, despite the fact I was doing that. So I saw her for years, and then now I have another woman. I'll talk about that more later. I have a woman now. I use a weighed and measured food plan. It works very, very well for me, and I'll chat with you about that when I get there. But she's, science-based and very, I like numbers. My husband's an MIT guy, so I'm a writer, I'm an artist type, but there's a part of me that, really respects that, kind of the logic and the simplicity of numbers, right? But, so those two women have been very, very helpful to me. But I just wasn't done with the food. That was the thing. I just wasn't done. That's all it is. That's all it was, is I just wasn't done. And to say to somebody that you don't get to work the steps in a 12-step program until you're done is absolutely ludicrous to me. Aside from the fact, how do you think somebody's going to move to the point where they are done if they're not working the steps? Right? How do you think that's going to happen? And people will say, like, even at this last workshop I was at last week, and somebody, you know, on the Q&A, somebody said, yeah, but, you know, doesn't Dr., you know, Silkworth say more often than not an alcoholic needs to be clear of alcohol before, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, before, you know, his brain can be, you know, clear enough for him to work the steps? And I said, okay, well, more often than not, right? He says more often than not. And I just don't think the same thing is true about alcoholism as is true about an eating disorder. I just don't. It's like apples and oranges, right? They're completely different. They are completely, completely different. There's something much, much different about eating, aside from the fact that you still have to eat. But it's something, it's a problem, you know, and I guess if you had a mom who's, you know, smoked pot or drank tequila while she was pregnant with you, that could be something that starts in utero too. But I mean, it's something that, it's just too deep. There's something too significant going on with an eating disorder. I just think it's definitely, definitely possible, because it worked from my experience, for somebody to be in a process of letting go. Okay. So now I'm about 8 years into this slipping, right, in Overeaters Anonymous, and I encountered a wonderful sponsor, and this woman just changed my life. And again, I don't know if she, I'm just going to call her, let's just call her Diane, right? I don't know if she wants to be outed, if this is going to end up somewhere. But this woman changed my life in Overeaters Anonymous. And she is in Los Angeles, has a very powerful job in the film industry. And she had four sponsees, and she talked to us around the clock. So she would start at 7:30 in the morning, and she'd finish up at 8:30, right? And you had a time spot in that 15-minute block, and she said, you know, she said the thing, very thing that I say to my sponsees now, she said, you know, your call time is at 8:15. If you call at 8:15, we'll talk for 15 minutes. If you call at 8:20, we're going to talk for 10. If you call at 8:25, we'll talk for 5. If you keep that up, I'm probably going to lovingly let you go, because you don't want what I have. Right? So she introduced me to boundary setting, which was a wonderful thing. So that was the first wonderful thing that she did for me, that Diane did for me. And the other thing she did is she said, your abstinence starts now. So I don't care what you're eating, your abstinence is starting now. I'm making that declaration for you. And if you're conclusively taking a third step, like it talks about on page 60 to 63 in the big book, she said, you're surrendering your will and your life to God. Right? Well, I'm working as God's emissary on your behalf, right? So I'm holding on to your abstinence right now. You're no longer in charge, and your abstinence starts now. So it's no longer a rehearsal, right? Because that was always my thing. Am I on or am I off? Am I in the food so that anything goes? I can do whatever I want to do in life, right? I can eat what I want. I can read People magazine instead of The New Yorker. Right, I can do whatever I want because I'm off. But then when I'm on, it's like, no, People magazine, no, right? PBS, right? Yes, right? Fox, no. I mean, that's literally how it was, right? Was I on or was I off? That's how I've been living my life. And she said, no, we're done. That's over. You're absent, and it's starting right now. So that also was a big shift for me, and I probably moved down. You know, so I was kind of dancing between the 170, 155. That probably took me down another 5, 10 pounds. Again, just moving me from, you know, I was still kind of doing this routine for the next 4 years before I got abstinent. She had declared me abstinent before I got off the sugar, right? Because I got relieved of the obsession with sugar, and I'll get there. But again, do you see what I'm saying? So I start here at 200 pounds. Got the recovery work in the steps, so now I'm bouncing around down here. This took me down a little bit more because somebody was basically saying, no, this is your life. Your life is on. So if you eat a sheet cake, right, your life is still on. It's still on. And that was a game changer for me. That was a game changer for me. Yet another game changer, right? And then that woman, we went through the steps. We did the Overeaters Anonymous literature, and we did went through that workbook, right? Did those steps in that workbook. And then I finished the steps with her. It took me a couple of years. Again, I moved slowly. And she said, well, now I want you to go get another sponsor. I love you. She blew kisses, and she said, go get another sponsor and work the steps with somebody else. Because you know what I'm going to say now. You know how this works. And she used to talk to me 5 days a week as she talked to all her sponsees, and then it was a floating call on weekends. So this woman changed my life, right? We were talking, what, 300 minutes a month? That changed my life. I literally stopped grinding my teeth at night. I mean, it was a pretty profound thing to have that love that it talks about in, I love that in the OA literature in the second step, and it's talking about how we start replacing food with the love of people in the group. You know, that's how we start kind of getting ourselves familiar with the idea of God and a God that will solve our problem by really falling in and embracing the love of the group. And I always, you know, I love that. I love that. And so then I got another sponsor, right, and was continuing on in the process. So again, came in program in 88, encountered Diane, and then, God, I guess it was, right, okay, so I encountered Diane, so my absence got declared in 2000, but so now for the first 4 years of my abstinence, I was still, you know, in and out of the sugar periodically, right? Again, not as much, and the quantities weren't as big, but I was still in and out of the food, and I had now started graduate school, and I had a boyfriend, and we got engaged, and we were... Well, that's another part of the story. It's a longer story. We were engaged for 10 years before we got married. I know. It was funny. And we were both, you know, it was the first marriage for both of us. We were just middle-aged, frightened people, I guess. But at any rate, so for the first 4 years of my absence, I was still kind of struggling with the food, struggling with the sugar. And finally, one day I just thought, you know what? I probably don't have a bottom with sugar. Maybe I'm always going to be one of those people who every once in a while goes in and out of sugar. Now, if you did it in a reasonable way, even like there are some people in OA, I think, who do it in a reasonable way, if I did it in a reasonable way, that would be fine. But I don't do sugar reasonably. I don't. I mean, I have a filling or a crown in just about every molar in my mouth, right? Well, I'm hoping this guy's going to go away. At any rate, so I kind of reconciled myself. I thought, you know, I must just not have a bottom. Maybe sometimes I'm going to be a, you know, 14, 12, 14. Other times maybe I'm going to be a 10, sometimes an 8, maybe a weekend. I'd hit like weekends of being an 8, right? Maybe that's how it's going to go with me. And again, numbers and sizes are very uninteresting, but it's just kind of, you know what we're tracking here, right? You know, you get the conversation we're having. But I thought, I guess that's just how it's going to be. I'm just not, I don't really have a bottom, and it's no big deal. And, you know, my husband loves me, or my boyfriend, fiancé, whatever he was at the time. He loves me no matter what I weigh, so there it is. So I'd had a real breakthrough that was on its way to happening with my career and my mother in the end of 2003. And so something happened after Thanksgiving, because I'm imagining I did it after Halloween and after Thanksgiving, but I got free of sugar again, right? So I was in one of my periods where I'm not going to be eating sugar. And I got about 7 or 8 weeks, right? So I got through the holiday season, got through New Year's, and it's July, it's Tuesday. It's Tuesday, July 13th. Yep, it's Tuesday, July 13th, January 13th, Tuesday, January 13th, 2004, and I've been off sugar now for about 8 weeks, and who knows what happened. My husband and I have gone out to dinner, we're doing a late dinner, and who knows, maybe the waiter looked at me cross-eyed or whatever, but I decided I was going to have sugar again, right, because I'm powerless, yeah, and so my husband and I have had dinner. It's about 11 o'clock at night, or probably 10:30, 10:45. And I decide I'm going to be one of those Hollywood types who's going to share a dessert with my husband, right? We're sitting at a table, and we're going to share a dessert, right? And so the waiter sets down the dessert, right? And it's one of those Hollywood restaurants, so it's like really ornate, crazy dessert. And I'm like, really? I just give me a spoon and, you know, a vat of something. But okay, right? Okay. So we're sharing the dessert. Except... there's a problem, because my husband is eating twice as much as I am, and I know he is because I'm counting. Right? I'm counting bites. So, like, I'm eating one, and he's eating two for every one. So now we've got a problem, right? Because it's 11 o'clock at night. I've now kicked in what Silkworth talks about, right? The allergy of the body. The obsession of the mind never goes away. That's why we have to work the steps, and we get to do service for the rest of our lives, because we never are free of that obsession of the mind, right? Haven't you had that experience? You're absent umpteen years, and all of a sudden you're watching a commercial, and you think,
whoa, they make that now? What does that taste like? Wow, look at that. Check that out. Right? So that never goes away. But now I've kicked in the allergy of the body. And we've got a real problem because it's 11 o'clock at night. I've gone through the holiday season, a potent emotional time, with a couple of months off sugar, and now I'm back in the sugar. Right? We are in trouble. So I'm already planning the lie. Remember, chronic slippers are chronic liars and chronic victims. So I'm sitting with my husband at the restaurant. So now it's like I got to get out of here. So it's like, waiter, check, please. You know, check, check. Right? Because it's like, I got to get out of here. Right? I got to get out of here immediately. And I need to get sugar. And none of the things that we have at our house, we don't have that much, but my husband just likes dreadful things. None of the things he likes are anything that I would eat if I'm in the sugar. So now I've got to get my hands on more sugar. And it's got to happen quickly. So I'm already planning the lie, right? Like, what? How am I going to do this? So I'm thinking, you know, we're walking to the car, and I'm thinking, I know. I'll tell him that I'm on my period and I need to get tampons, okay? And then, okay, but wait a minute, because now I've got to explain why I didn't think about that until we got home. And now, okay, I need another lie because I have to explain why I want to be the one at 11 o'clock at night who wants to go out and get the tampons while you go in the house and take care of the dogs, right? And it's like, well, wait a minute, though, but hang on. He might remember that I just finished my period about a week ago. So I know ovarian cysts. Ovarian cysts, right? I'm literally like, you know, blah, 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 just like it talks about in the big book. It says we're fine, upstanding people. But around my drug of choice, all bets are off, right? All bets are off. And I'm a writer. I get paid to tell stories. I do this very well, right? So, I already, like, had the lie planned, right? And it's like, oh, ovarian cysts? I didn't know. Yeah, didn't you know I'd been to Dr. Boynton? Yeah, Boynton. Saw him yesterday. Didn't want to worry you, right? I mean, like, it's so easy for me. It comes very, very naturally to me, yes? And my hand touched the handle of the door. So, again, it's 2004. I've been in program now and I've been abstinent in OA, and I was always honest with the sponsor, and my sponsor was in charge, right? And she said, you're abstinent, and my next sponsor said the same thing, you're fine, right? So I was always in integrity in that regard. I had not lied to a sponsor. I don't know that I've ever really lied to a sponsor. I mean, I guess there were lies. My sponsor's like, my sponsor's sitting right here. He's like, oh, really? Really? Remember that period of time where you, like, you know, lied by omission? So, you know, that's probably part of it too. But my deal is, if a sponsor says to me, have you eaten A, B, and C? And if I have, I'm not going to say, no, I haven't. Right. I just know. I mean, I already know how far that puts you behind the starting line, right? So I'd been honest with my sponsor. So I had 4 years of abstinence. I had 12 years of slipping behind me. And here I am already planning this lie that I'm going to tell because I've gotten back into the sugar, right? And I'm, what, 16 years sober at that point, right? Clean sober. And so my hand touches the handle of the door, and all of a sudden I thought, wow, I'm glad I don't live in a high-rise. Where did that thought come from? And I got it in that moment. I got powerlessness. I got it. That I could no longer guarantee that if I kept eating sugar, I couldn't guarantee that I wasn't going to take myself out of the game. Like, I got it in that moment. I finally got powerlessness. I'd never gotten it before. I got it. That if I kept eating sugar, I might one day just take myself out. It was amazing to me. And just like years before, 16 years before, I didn't want to kill somebody's kids. I'd grown and evolved to the point there with 16 years of sobriety, 4 years of abstinence, still fooling around with food a little bit, but 16 years of recovery, because it doesn't matter if you're chronically slipping. If you're here, you're recovering. At the end, when we hold hands and we say, it works if you work it, I don't say that. I say it's working. It doesn't matter what you're doing here. If you're here, it's working. Right? So, I got it in that moment that I couldn't keep this up. Something bad was going to happen. So what did I do the next day? Right. So there was no lie. There were no ovarian cysts that night. Right. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Right. Right. I'm sure I gave my husband plenty of other drama because I feel sorry for him when I've been off sugar for 2 months and all of a sudden I'm back in it now. Right. What a lovely thing for him. But what did I get up and do the next day? I had sugar again. Right. Like, that's the insanity, right? So I had it again on Wednesday the 14th. And then on the 15th in 2004, the sugar obsession was removed from me. And I haven't had it since.
Now, I've probably had it, you know, where it was maybe, because I don't eat sugar, or any of her evil stepsisters, if it's fifth or higher, if it's fourth or higher, right? So everything has to be fifth or lower for me. But, and I'm sure there are times where it's been, you know, third or fourth, and maybe even second at one point. But it certainly was never anything I did regularly, and, you know, I paid the price for it quickly enough and was always honest with my sponsor about it. But I haven't done the things that are my drug of choice, which are like ice cream and anything with fat. You know, I need sugar and fat combined, so I don't, like, I would never eat jelly beans, but if, you know, I poured butter on them, maybe. But, you know, like, I mean, it has to be a sugar-fat combination for me. But, so I got relieved. So it was amazing. It was a miracle. So I haven't had sugar since 2004. And then, you know, found my way, and there are wonderful ways to do this. You know, in Overeaters Anonymous, we have the Dignity of Choice pamphlet, which has weighed and measured food plans. I also had sought out, there's, you know, other programs where people do weighing and measuring and stuff. OA has always been my mother program, so this has always been my, you know, my primary place. But, you know, there was a period of time where I really needed to be in a place where, because I love Overeaters Anonymous, but I got to tell you, sometimes it's really hard to sit in yet another meeting where I'm listening to people debate about whether or not frozen yogurt counts as dinner. You know what I mean? Like, really? Really? So that gets hard for me sometimes. And so anyway, so, you know, I go to OA for the most part, and then I, you know, spend some time also in the program where people kind of take it a little bit more. They're a little bit more structured in terms of dealing with the food, and let's truly get the food moved out of the way so we can get on with the business of living a life, right? Being free. But, and I started doing the workshops because, again, after I put a couple years of abstinence together and coupled with not being in the sugar, right, and then really the vista presented itself, and I just got very clear I really wanted to be of service to people who were chronically slipping. And because I started encountering people who needed sponsorship, and there were people, again, who were saying, well, you can't start working the steps until you put the food down. And that just didn't make any sense to me. Because, again, my life had changed because I had worked the steps, despite the fact I was continuing to eat the sugar and still overeating, right? But then I, you know, got a great sponsor. Susie's been my sponsor for 7 or 8 years, and, you know, she's... Other than my husband, well, she probably actually knows more about my husband because she knows the stuff that I don't tell my husband because it's the stuff I'm bitching about with my husband, right? Mm-hmm. So Susie knows more about me than any person on the planet because, well, my parents are deceased, but my mother, you know, my mother and I didn't have that kind of relationship anyway. We could have, but she didn't, you know, the diabetes took her out. But, you know, so I would, you know, I would fall at Susie's feet. I'd do anything. Anybody who's ever sponsored me, right, I would, you know, I would do just about anything. I'd give my life for them. But, and she changed my life. I mean, her love literally transformed me. So I wanted to be of service to people who were chronically slipping. So I started doing, you know, putting these workshops together. So the workshop was really an attempt to bring people in, because let's do a show of hands. Who came in and they got abstinent in OA right away and they've never lost their abstinence? Okay, all right. Okay, well, this is very unusual. Good, great. Well, you're my people, right? Because, you know, normally there's, you know, people who come in and they've, you know, they've done it right from the beginning. There's a lot of them in Los Angeles, right? And they always sit right in the front, and they're always like, yes, me, right? But they're so cute. They're so cute. I'm like, oh, that's so cute, right? It's great. But, you know, sorry, so then look around, right? So then all of us then are people who, you know, it came, lost it, came, lost it, came, lost it, right? Well, we need to be of service to people who, for whatever reason, and I don't know what the, you seem like a happy, well-adjusted group of people. They ain't in Los Angeles, right? Don't tell them that. But there are people who, for whatever, and I've seen them for years, there are people who, for whatever reason, feel like they haven't been invited to the party. And somehow they think that something's being withheld from them, right? And that's where we get into this whole idea about, let's start working together and let's start looking at your lying. And let's start looking at your chronic victimhood. Because here's what I can tell you. Okay, now let's do this. Raise your hand if you're not abstinent today. Okay, so we got a couple people here. Okay, so everybody else is abstinent. Okay, that means it's the responsibility of everybody else in the group. Our primary purpose is to stay abstinent and help them. That's my primary purpose. I mean, if you believe what it talks about in the book, we're going to talk about that. But if you believe what it says in the book, that's our job, right? So, like, everybody should have paid attention to the people who raised their hands. That's my job. That's my primary purpose. If you believe what we do here, and you really are on board, That's the deal. So then it becomes, how do I help those people? Because I have found with chronic slippers that there's certain things that need to be going on with chronic slippers. And I was lucky because I kind of fell into it piecemeal, and so I started paying attention to what those things were. So here are some of the things I do with chronic slippers, right? So one of the first things we do right away is we have a conversation. Okay, we started at 1:30, right? So our first break's at 3. We have a conversation right at the beginning where I tell them, I say, you know, first of all, I'm one of you, did this for a dozen years, right? Been here 24 years, only have a dozen years of abstinence. I, too, am a chronic slipper. Don't worry about the label. Because people will sometimes say, like, oh, but the label, I don't want to be the label. It's like, you know what? Okay, all right, you don't want to call, you know, Bill Wilson called himself a chronic slipper. So did Dr. Bob. But, okay, you don't want to be a chronic slipper, call yourself a rainbow. Right? Be a rainbow. Do, you know, whatever. He said, okay. I said, I'm just telling you, I'm a chronic slipper, and I don't have a problem with it, right? But, okay, if you do, fine. I'm a chronic slipper, you're a rainbow. But I'm just telling you then, here's what rainbows have in common. You're chronic slippers, and you're chronic liars, and you're a chronic victim. So let's start looking at that. You want to look at that? Mary? Right? That's how we start. And they said, well, what do you mean I'm a chronic liar? And I said, here's the thing. I can't get anybody abstinent. If I could, I wouldn't have a dead mother and a dead brother. And they both died from diabetes, right? And my brother died at 36 years old, right? Diagnosed at 15, died 21 years later. And it wasn't a pretty death, because it's not a pretty death when you die of diabetes, right? He'd had both of his legs were gone. He was on dialysis for the last 3 years of his life, and he'd gone blind. And he was in an old people's home for the last 3 years of his life. And when he went blind, he said, that's it. I'm not going to live blind. Take me off dialysis. And they took him off dialysis, and he was dead by the end of the weekend, right? So he just said, I wasn't going to live blind, right? And he'd lost both of his legs. But when you're diabetic and you've lost both of your legs, they don't just take off both of your legs, right? They start with the baby toe, then the next two, then below the ankle, then above the ankle, then below the knee, right? Then they're starting on the other leg. My brother was literally, because in addition to his diabetes, like me and like my mother, he had a sugar addiction. He was one of us, right? So he could not stop eating the sugar. He was losing his body piece by piece, and he couldn't stop eating his sugar. That's the kind of sugar eating I come from, right? Couldn't stop. He could not stop. Couldn't stop. Same thing happened to my mom 16 years later. Just happened quicker. So my mom got the diabetes, the less serious one, right, where you have to take the pills and then kind of modulate your diet. But she couldn't do that, right? My mom was close to 250 pounds at that point. Couldn't do it. Couldn't put the sugar down. And within 6 months, my mom was in a coma, in a hospital. She'd already lost about a leg and a half at that point, and she died in a coma in the hospital. Died of a staph infection while she was in a coma in the hospital. She couldn't stop eating sugar, right? That's the kind of sugar eating I come from, right? This isn't even talking about the drug addiction and alcoholism in my family, right? So we got a lot of ism. And she just, you know, they just couldn't stop. So I really understand people who are chronic slippers and who feel like they just can't stop and can't put it down. And I have, you know, there are plenty of people who just get really frustrated by chronic slippers. I just don't. I really understand. I really understand somebody standing in front of a wall, right? You're 40 feet from a wall. You bend over, you run as fast as you can into the wall, you wham into the wall, right? And then you fall on the floor, you kind of get up and you shake your head, you know, like Wile E. Coyote, you know, doy-oy-oy-oy-oy. You look at the wall again, you think, wow, that was a mistake. And then you turn around and you face this wall. And you bend over and you run into that wall and you do the same thing again, right? I so get that. I absolutely get that. Having done it for a dozen years, I so get that. Doesn't frustrate me a bit. I absolutely understand it. I understand the pain. There's only one reason that somebody stays in the food. Because they're in pain. They're in pain. And they don't get it that the pain, the familiar pain, is actually much worse than they realize. You know, there's a great movie called Searching for Bobby Fischer. And at the end of this movie, the protagonist, the little boy, is playing a chess match with this other boy, the antagonist. And the protagonist is, he's a great kid, right? Of course, he's a hero. And he He's a chess master or grandmaster, whatever the poobah, whatever it's called in chess. And he's, you know, like chess poobahs can do, right? They know, however many moves ahead, they can figure out 30 moves ahead. And when you've got two brilliant chess players, right? Somebody's going to make a move, you know the next move the other person's going to make, right? Because there is one best move, right? So this guy has got it, this kid, this Josh, has got it figured out 21 moves ahead. That he's going to beat this antagonist, right? He's going to win the big, because this is the grand championship, and he's going to win. So he offers that kid a draw. You know, he puts his hand up. And despite the fact that Josh doesn't have as many pieces on the board, he doesn't even have his queen anymore, and the other kid does, Josh realizes he's going to win the chess match. So he offers the kid a draw. And the antagonist won't take the draw. And Josh says, no, take the draw. Let's share the championship. And the other kid says, no, are you kidding me? Look at the board. You're not going to win. Are you crazy? And Josh says, take the draw. And the kid says, no, move. And Josh kind of sighs and shakes his head. And he says, you've lost. You just don't know it yet. And that's what's true with chronic slippers, right? They've lost. They just don't know it yet, right? That's just the reality. I know that. As a sponsor, as somebody with a dozen years of slipping and a dozen years of abstinence, I know that. Now, you can't, you know, I'm not going to be mean to you. You can't, you know, if being mean to somebody was going to solve their weight problem, my dad would have solved my weight problem in childhood, right? So I know that doesn't work. I'm not going to shame anybody. But what I always tell people, I can't get you abstinent. Dead mom, dead brother, right? If I could get you abstinent, I'd be celebrating Mother's Day with my mommy. Right? I can't get you abstinent, but I can help you figure out the lie. Because somewhere, if you want to be abstinent and you're not, or if you are abstinent and you're eating things that you don't want to be eating, or if you're abstinent and you're heavier than you want to be, somewhere you're telling yourself a lie. And all I'm saying is, let's stop lying. Let's just start telling the truth. Let's stop lying. Let's stop lying. Stop lying about it, right? Just tell the truth. Just acknowledge that food is the most important thing to you in the world. It's more important than your husband, your cat, your dog, your kids, your car, your house, whatever it is, your graduate school, whatever it is. Food is the most important thing to you in life. And as long as you can live with that, have at it. But stop lying. Don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. That's just the reality. It just is. And it's really important to stop lying. So I always tell people, this is a safe place for you to not lie. I want you to be able to tell the truth about your food. I don't care what you eat. I don't have the power to get you abstinent. That's God's job. What I can do is we're going to do the work. We are going to work the steps no matter what. And if you don't want to do that, I can't help you. Right? And this isn't the only way to do it. Because I give my sponsees, they have a lot of work to do. My sponsees, because by the time they get to me, these are people who've been doing this for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I just sponsored a couple women. They've been doing it for, they were women in their 50s, been doing this for 25 years. By the time they get to me, it's time to do a meeting a day. That's just the point we've gotten to. That's just the point we've gotten to. And yeah, we can, you know, squeeze in a couple of phone meetings in lieu of live meetings, but you know what? And if you're in AA, yeah, one of those AA meetings will count, or one in Al-Anon meeting or something, that's fine. But more meetings than not during the course of a week have to be food meetings, because it's your food meeting that got you to the point where you're asking somebody to sponsor you who's telling you to do a bunch of stuff, right? That's how you've bottomed out. You bottomed out with food. So you got to spend more time in the food meetings because you hurt. And you need to be in the meetings, not to be shamed. You need to be in the meetings to embrace that love that it talks about. In the OA book, embrace the love of the group. Let us love you. Right? So we're going to do a meeting a day. Right? We're actually going to work. You know how we have the 9 tools in OA? The action plan is just, I strike that from the list. I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? What is that? What is that? So I call them the 8 tools, and I've actually turned them into the 10 tools, right? And you're going to work, my sponsees are going to work all of those tools. And we're going to go through the steps as they're outlined in the big book. We're going to do that after the break. But, you're going to be working all 8 of those tools, plus prayer and meditation, which I've added as 2 more tools, so it's basically 10 tools. You're going to be working those every day, for the 2 months that we're working together. And you're going to send me an email at night confirming that you've worked those tools, right? So this is kind of the conversation I'm having with this person, right? And I'm just waiting for them to say, you know, actually, no. Thank you. Thank you, but no. And it just, you know, it doesn't, as a general rule, it doesn't happen. And, you know, there's not one right way to do this. This is not the only way to sponsor. Everybody in this room who's abstinent and sponsors people does it differently. This is just something I've found that works well from my experience, and it seems to work well with the chronic slippers that I work with. But I always tell people, if you're drowning, a blue boat, a red boat, a purple boat, a green boat, a red boat, brown boat can save your life. But get out of the water. Get in a boat, right? Get in a boat. The sharks are circling, right? You know what you are? Chum, right? Get in a boat. So if you want to, you know. But if you do get in a boat, if you get in my boat, you've gotten in a red boat. And if you're in my boat, well, I'm not the captain, right? God's the captain, right? We're real clear about that. God is the body of water that we're on. I'm real clear that God's the captain, but I'm at least the first mate, right? All I know is I'm higher than you, right? Because you're in my boat, right? Supposedly I have what you want. I know I don't want what you have. Right? I mean, that's pretty fair. I think that's fair. Right? Isn't that legitimate? Right? And when, you know, and sometimes sponsees will get angry with you, you know, and they think that, you know, they'll hop off and they'll say, well, I'm going to let you go because I don't want what you have. And I say, that's okay. On my bad days, I don't want what I have. That's all right. That's all right. You're not hurting my feelings. Right? Run off in a huff. You're getting back in the water. And you know what? It's really okay if you're in my boat and you decide, I don't want to be in your boat. That's just fine. Remember, all we're doing here is we're trying to get to truth-telling. I'm going to hold your hand. I'm going to row you up alongside another boat and hold your hand while you're getting in that boat. And then I'm going to blow kisses while you're being sailed, motored, paddled away, whatever it is, hoping that you're going to make outreach calls, right? Because it's not about, there's not one right way to do this. But this is how you do it if you're in my boat, right? So we're going to work all those tools at night. So I don't have any, and I always tell people, you know, you're not surrendering to me. This is not, I'm not on some power trip. I am a card-carrying member of Al-Anon. So you're not surrendering your will and your life to me. You're conclusively taking the third step like it talks about in the big book. Very specifically, the paragraph at the top of page 63. That's what you're doing. I'm just a channel who's giving you direction as we're both looking heavenward, or for me, God is within, inward, right, to access that greater source to find out what to do so that I can have access to the real freedom that it talks about that happens if I conclusively take a third step. In that paragraph, it says, I'll be free of fear today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. That's just if I take a third step. That's pretty powerful promises. Don't kid yourself. That big book, those 9-step promises are not the only promises. You can find promises on every page of that book, right? But that's a pretty powerful one. Free of fear today, tomorrow, or life after life, or life after death, as people call it. That's pretty powerful. And all I have to do is not be in charge. All I have to do is not have any good ideas. That's what I tell sponsees. Be out of good ideas. Just be out of good ideas. You know why? You don't have any. You don't have any. Trust me. You don't. And that's the good news. I don't either. I got a sponsor. I've got her. I've got somebody in AA. Got somebody in Al-Anon. Got another person I kind of chat with. Right? Be out of good ideas. You don't have any. Right? So this is what we're going to do. Right? You're going to, if the deal is, if you want to, I don't care about your food. I don't care what you eat. But you need to start getting honest. And you need to tell somebody about it. And you need to tell me. Because I'm your sponsor. So I tell people, I say, get a little notebook. This is what I would say to the people who raise their hand that aren't absent. This is what I say to Andy. This is what I just said to somebody this morning on a phone call. Get a little notebook and start writing down everything that you eat in real time, including the quantities. Write the time, what you ate, and the quantities. Right? You have to write the quantity. I mean, you can't write, well, I had a cheeseburger and bag of Doritos for lunch, because I don't know if that's the size you get at 7-Eleven or the one you get at Costco. Right? So you got to give me, you know, you got to throw me a bone. Right? So let me know the quantities, what you ate, and the time you ate it. Start writing it down in real time. If you start doing that, I would say that's somebody in or out of program, right? Somebody who wants to deal with their, you know, control their weight and they don't want to do a diet or whatever it is, whatever conversation they're having. Just start writing down your food. Just start writing down your food, right? I paid big money to get that little nugget from a registered dietitian. Take it for free, right? Stand on my shoulders. Don't do what I did. Don't do what I did. I wasted my 30s. One of the reasons I'm married and don't have children is because my childbearing years, I was eating chocolate, right? Don't do what I did. Stand on my shoulders, right? So you're going to report, they're going to report their food. And if you want to commit your food ahead of time, and here's the news. This is funny. I did the workshop last week, right? And this woman came up to me afterwards. And again, I have no opinion what anybody should weigh. I have no opinion at all. And I know we're all not supposed to look like this, right? And all women are princesses and all men are princes, right? Everybody's beautiful and perfection. But if you are somebody who wants to really get thin, and this woman came up, she was probably 300 pounds after the workshop, and oh, love the workshop, blah, 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 blah. And she wants to be a size 2, right? She said, I want to be a size 2. What do I do? I said, well, you actually just sat through a 3-hour workshop, right? I think I told you what to do, but okay, let's just break this down quickly. I said, well, here's what I think you're going to find. I think if you want to be really thin, particularly if you're somebody who's coming from 300 pounds, I think what you're going to find is that you're going to need to weigh and measure your food. She said, well, I can't do the intuitive eating. I said, in my experience, I've never met anybody in these rooms, if you subscribe to the philosophy that we have, right, the idea that we have that it's a spiritual problem I have, it's not a physical problem, right? It'd be great if being overweight, if being fat had been my biggest problem. That would be great. Not even close. My biggest problems, the two problems I had, are the same two problems that I have today to a much lesser extent. I do not love readily, and I do not forgive readily. You or me. Those are my problems, if you really break it down, right? Same problems that I struggle with today, but to a much lesser extent. It was not, being a size 16, 18 was not my biggest problem. You know how I know that? Because I'm a size 6, I've been a size 6 for a long time, and I got plenty of problems, right? My husband will not consistently put a napkin in his lap. And it just jerks my chain, right? For starters. So that's how I know that being overweight was not my problem. Now, thin is not well. That's true. We know that, right? Well, neither is fat. That's not well either. So since we can agree on that, right, conclusively, right, that thin is not well and fat is not well, so that means we can come in the room and we don't have to judge anybody or make any decisions about anybody based on how they look here. We don't have to decide who I listen to and who has value or whatever based on what they weigh. You don't have enough information. You don't have enough information at all, right? So anyway, so this woman came up and she said, well, what about the intuitive eating? And I said, well, I said, from my experience being here for a long time, I can just tell you, I have never seen anybody in the rooms who does the intuitive eating thing who's really, really, really thin in the way that you're describing, because you want to be a size 2. A 2, is it? Right? She's like a 50-year-old woman. You want to be a 2. Okay. That's just my experience. Now, you know, run the race, Roger Bannister. Show me. Prove it. Do it. Go for it if you want to. I think you're making too hard work of it. I think that's going to be too hard. But, you know, I had an RD, the first RD I had, tried to get me to do the intuitive eating thing. Well, I don't have any intuition, I'm sorry to say, around food. I don't. I just don't. I remember when I was growing up and my mom had those little AIDS candies. They were like caramels in a box. They were wonderful, right? And, so my mom was like on diets and stuff. And I remember, you know, why are you eating these? Why are you eating the candy if you want to lose weight, Mom? And she said, well, they take away your appetite, so you don't want to eat. And I remember just as a kid thinking, well, you don't have to have an appetite to be eating. I don't know if I'm hungry most of the time I'm eating. Like, who cares, right? Game on. It's on the table. Who cares? And I was a kid. I was maybe 10 years old and I got that, right? So I said to the woman, you know, I'm not sure about the intuitive eating thing. What I have found from my own experience is that I needed to, I needed to do the weighing and measuring thing. But, you know, and she was just crestfallen because she's not... So the pain of what she interprets as the pain of having to weigh and measure or go see an RD or get a food plan or follow one of the plans in Dignity of Choice or whatever is greater to her than the pain that she's in right now. That's all it means. Doesn't mean she has, you know, she's any of those, anything, right? Because there's a lot of judging and finger wagging that goes on here, right? We know that's true. We know that's true. It just is. It just is. You know, there are people sitting in the back of the rooms all the time in meetings. And they feel like they haven't been invited to the party. Meanwhile, I want to come in and I want to sit in the front and sure, I'll lead your meeting. Yeah, and all that stuff, right? I want to do all that stuff. I'm supposed to be getting their phone numbers, calling them. That's what I'm supposed to be doing, right? Anyway, so we're going to work all those tools. So you're going to commit your food to me. And if you want to commit your food ahead of time, and I always encourage people to do that. And I also tell them, I say the same 10 tools that you're sending to me, I send those to my sponsor. I send those every night. I email the same thing to my sponsor. I do a meeting probably 5-6 days a week. Some days it's 7 days. Some weeks. Right? And I got quite a bit of time here. So, you know, it's not like they can even retreat and say, well, I don't have time for it. I say, really? Are you sure about that? Because I'm kind of making time. You sure? So, you're going to commit your food. So, what I do to my sponsor is I commit my food ahead of time, the night before. And I'm really trying to work to be in integrity and actually eat what I've committed. Because I can't deny it anymore that there's something going on if I commit my food and I can't follow that commitment. That's saying something in the world. Right, it just is. And I don't want to, you know, don this cloak, but I'm just going to say it. You know, there's something going on. If I can't do what I say I'm doing, somehow I'm not embodying the strength of a woman of my word in the world, right? But I don't know. I take that cloak on, I put it on, put it off, put it on, put it off. You know, because I'm not going to be mean to myself. I'm not going to use any of the tools because, again, I just know that doesn't work. But for some reason, I'm just not quite there yet that I commit. But today I've actually done it so far, right? Knock on whatever this is, right? So today I've done it so far. So, you know, I really want to work on that one. But what I do is I commit my food to my sponsor the night before, and then the next night when I'm doing it again, I let her know if I deviated at all. Right? And so food plan, I will have a thing that says service, you know, have I done service, right? And being quiet at meetings when others have shared, you know, are sharing, right? Sponsorship, have I connected with my sponsor? Have my sponsees connected with me? Have I made myself available? Meeting, did I get to a meeting? Anonymity, do I keep my mouth shut about who I see here, right? And that's not just, that doesn't mean, you know, if I go out in the world and I don't tell them that I saw, you know, Joni and Tommy at this meeting today. That doesn't also mean that. That means Joni and Tommy, who are here today, if I go out and I see Betsy, and again, I don't have my glasses on, so, you know, I'm not crazy. I don't know what your names are. I can't read those tags. So if I see Betsy out there, or I see, you know, I see Betsy, another Betsy who wasn't here today, I don't say, oh, Tommy and Joni, do you know them? They're in program, right? Do you know them? Tommy and Joni, yeah, they're friends. They're in program. Or if they walk up and Betsy walks up, I don't say, oh, yeah, you know, we're all in program together. I don't do that. I keep my mouth shut. I don't tell people in program that other people are in program. Now, people, and the only place I make an exception with that is with my sponsor. I can tell my sponsor anything. Because I know my sponsor, in the same way that I'll handle it with my sponsees, I will keep you in integrity. I will keep you from being a victim. So if you're going to come to me and you're going to gossip about somebody in a meeting, that's fine. You go for it. We'll get this handled as soon as you're done jabbering, right? So run with it. Run with it. Then we'll take care of business, right? But that's the only place I make an exception. I do not tell people in program that other people are in program. I don't. And I set up people a lot of times on blind dates, friends of mine. And I'll always say to, you know, Jim, I'll say, Jim, now if I introduce you to somebody, do you want me to mention that I know you from OA or from AA? Or would you like me to keep my mouth shut? And then he'll, you know, usually they always say, yeah, sure, it's fine. And then I'll say, Mary, if I introduce you to somebody, do you want them to know that I know you from program? No, please don't let them know. I say, fine. Then I'll introduce Jim to Mary, and, you know, how do you know Mary? Friends of friends, right? Right? I keep my mouth shut. Anonymity is really, really important. We'll talk about that if we have time. We'll get to some of the stuff that's in the foreword and the preface that we can put two and two together about how membership has fallen so drastically in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we can't measure it anymore because now the big book and everything's on the internet, so we can no longer track it. But if you read the preface and the forewords, you can track every time they brought out a new edition of the book, they would track how many people were active in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at the time and how many books were circulating. And again, I don't have my big book with me, so I'm it goes something like this, that the first before they did the first printing, which I think was the second printing was in 54. So the first one came out in 39, second one came out in 54, and there were 150,000 alcoholics and there were 300,000 books circulating, right? The next year, when it came out in 76, there were 1.15 million books circulating and there were a million sober alcoholics, right? So it was very close, the number of books and the number of alcoholics. In 2001, there were 19, let's just call it 20 million, it's like 19.7. There were 20 million books circulating, only 2 million people sober in Alcoholics Anonymous groups. So why did that fall off, right? Is that because people stopped paying attention to anonymity, right? And you hear some nitwit rock star who talks about how, you know, he went to AA, but it doesn't work for him. Is it that? Is it that kind of breaking of anonymity? Is it because in the 60s, people stopped doing big book studies? And book studies and they discussion groups started in the 60s. That was when we started discussion groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is it that? Is it that also in the 60s people stopped working the steps from the big book and they started using the 12 and 12? I don't know. I just know the steps are much more, there's a real hardiness to the steps in the big book that I don't find in the 12 and 12. And, you know, I love the 12 and 12. I mean, I'm grateful Bill wrote it when he was struggling in the midst of depression. I think it's commendable that he did it. I'm a writer. I think it's amazing to finish a book when you were struggling with depression the way that guy did. It's amazing. But it doesn't pack the punch that the big book does. Not at all. So who knows? At any rate, so those are all things, you know, we want to pay attention to. So that all kind of harkens back to anonymity with me. So literature, they're going to be writing and reading something on a daily basis. They're going to be writing for 15 minutes. Telephone. My sponsees all make 3 live outreach calls or double the number of message calls or any combination thereof. So write 2 live calls and 2 message calls or 1 live call and 4 message calls. And you have to leave your phone number and you have to leave it twice. The most ridiculous thing in the world to me is when I get an outreach call from somebody and they say, like, hi, it's Marcy making an outreach call. Just checking in. Hope you're having a great abstinent day. First of all, I hate that when people say having a great abstinent day. You know what? No, I'm binging and it's a wonderful day, okay? It's actually wonderful. But, bye, right? And she doesn't leave her phone number. That doesn't, for me, that doesn't count as an outreach call. It just doesn't. Because I'm not solving. Because again, you got to look at that. These are not perfunctory things. We're trying to solve the bigger problem here. I want to isolate. I just want to be left alone. Just leave me alone. And this is with a lot of recovery, right? In my bad moments, I just want to be left alone. So I got to solve that bigger problem. So if I'm making an outreach call and I don't reach somebody live, but I leave my phone number, and I always tell sponsees, leave your phone number twice, right? And then somebody can get back with me, right? And I always tell them when you're making an outreach call and somebody answers the phone, say, hi, this is Sheila. I'm making an outreach call from OA. Is this a convenient time for you? Right? Because then somebody will let you know if it's a good time for them. And I want to know. People, if they can't, they'll say, oh, no, I'm sorry. It's not. I'm so sorry. I say, no, don't be sorry. That's why I asked. Right? So it just makes me feel comfortable, makes you feel comfortable, and then I'm just solving that bigger problem, which is that I just want to be left alone. And then I've added prayer and meditation because, quite frankly, I think, well, and just between you and me, I think exercise should be a tool too, but I'm not, you know, walking down that gangplank with anybody, but especially somebody who's just coming out of the food. But prayer and meditation, my sponsees, you know, sit and say, you know, we're going to start the meditation. We're not waiting to step 11 for you, right? We want to access what it talks about in step 11 in the 12 and 12, where it says, it's on page 102, and it wraps around to 103, and it says, emotional balance is one of the first fruits of regular meditation. Well, that's a pretty good one too, right? I need that emotional balance. Right? So I say, we're going to meditate, you know, we're going to meditate for 5 minutes a day, and it starts today. And they say, you know, people, oh, I don't know how to meditate. I don't know how to do it. I say, sit down in a chair and shut up. Just start there. Just start there. Right?
We'll worry about, you know, we'll add whistles and buttons later, but just start there. And then pray, right? And I invite them to do, for the 2 months we're working together, to do the same prayers that I do in the morning, the ones that Diane directed me to do a dozen years ago that I still do. And it's the third step prayer. It's the first three steps. It's the serenity prayer. And then those are the three I want them to do. And then for me, I also have added the On Awakening, you know, the page 86 to 88 blitz in the book. And then I do another prayer of my own, an affirmative prayer of my own. And that's what I do every morning. And that's the stuff we're going to do. And that's not what's going to solve your problem and get you abstinent, right? It's the step work. And then we're going to work the steps. And we work the steps as they're outlined in the book. So I think what we'll do, because we do have a little bit of extra time. We did it when I did this last time, too, so this is good. So we'll take any questions that anybody might have about this part before we take our break. Does anybody have any questions so far?
Can you just run by that if you do the third step prayer, the page 86, 88 through 88, and what was...
I do the third step prayer. I do the first three steps, so I just run through those three steps, and then I do the serenity prayer. And then I do the page 86 through page 88. Yep.
I have a question.
Sure.
Is the third step prayer in the big book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The third step prayer is on page 63. Okay. We were now at step 3. Well, let's actually take a look at this, actually, because this is cool. Let's just read this paragraph now. We'll save it. But let's do the third step prayer, because we'll save that to when we go through the steps in the book. But we were now at step 3 again, so it's middle of 63. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me. Join with me if you want. To build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Yeah. Yep. So that's page 63. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yep.
Your food plan, when you talk about weighing and measuring,
yeah.
What are you weighing and measuring to?
Sure. I don't know what that means. What am I weighing and measuring to?
Example, you... 1,300 calories, and that's
oh.
to do it. I mean,
what
exactly is...
Sure, sure. Well, in the Dignity of Choice, right, which is NOAA pamphlet, right, they've got different food plans, so that would be, a good place to start. But what I did is I went to a registered dietitian. So I have an MS diagnosis. I've had a multiple sclerosis diagnosis for 18 years, and I'm very, very fortunate because I don't have any appreciable problems, and that's a miracle. And that's why I also can understand my diabetic mother and brother, right? Because I had doctors, and non-traditionals and traditionals, who said to me right in the beginning, don't eat dairy. Don't eat dairy. It's not good for you. It's, it leaves you open as somebody who has an autoimmune diagnosis. You want to avoid colds and flus and things like that. The jury is in on dairy. I mean, it creates mucus. You're going to be more susceptible to that stuff. Plus, don't do it for these other reasons. And I literally walked out of their offices. And the problem with me is a compulsive overeater. And now I've got a chronic illness diagnosis. Is now I have two diseases. And you know what trumps? My eating disorder trumps everything. So if I walk out of a doctor's office and they say, oh, this is bad for your health, don't eat A, B, and C, I'm going out and I'm not going to just eat them, I'm going to binge on them, and then I'm, D, E, F too, you know what I mean? So I so get that when somebody has all the reasons in the world. I remember years ago I sponsored somebody in and she had heard me share about my mother and my brother, and she wanted me to sponsor because she was struggling with diabetes. And this is a woman who had like a dozen of the surgeries, right? She had diabetes in program, and she kept getting the surgeries on her eyes. She was losing her sight and couldn't stop eating. Like people would, stop working with her because they got so frustrated with her. Not me. I understand that. Now, as long as you're willing to do the work, I can help you. But if you're not willing to do the work, I can't help you. And again, we'll talk about that when we get to the steps. But the book's real specific about that. On page 96 in the Working with Others, it says, we find it a waste of time to try and help a man who will not work with you. And if you keep trying to help them, you're going to, deprive others of the chance. Right? I'm paraphrasing. But that's the gist of it. So I make sure they get that right in the beginning. That's what my sponsees read. First thing they start reading is they read that Working with Others chapter. Because I want you to understand this. I can't help you if you don't do the work. You have to give me something. You either have to give me abstinence and the work, or you got to give me the work. But abstinence is not enough. If you call me, I don't care if you've done all the stuff, sent the emails, and you call me 3-4 days in a row, and you're staying abstinent, following your little food plan, little Miss Pris, doing your deal, but you're not doing the work, I'm going to lovingly let you go. I'm going to give you a couple opportunities to catch up on that, but if you don't, I'm going to lovingly let you go, because you're not going to be eating that way for long anyway, and you're not solving your bigger problem. I got a sponsor right now. I was just talking with my sponsor about it, somebody who's trying to get me on board, who's, you know, behaving with her food. Otherwise, she's, you know, her life is a mess. And I don't know that she's gonna do the deal with me. And I can't help you. I can't help you. I'm very uninterested in what you eat. Let's solve the bigger problem. Let's solve the real problem, right? Let's figure out why it is you don't want to be abstinent in the first place. Are you afraid if you get abstinent, maybe you're going to have to leave that husband who's knocking you around? Maybe you're going to have to go to graduate school and actually pursue the career that you really wanted to pursue instead of becoming a whatever it was because dad thought it was a good idea? Right? Who knows? You're going to have to start using birth control? I don't know. I don't know what it is. But let's figure it out. Let's stop lying, you know? Let's just do the deal and figure out, let's just get some truth-telling going on here. That's all. So, for me, I have a food plan from my registered dietitian, and it's not about calories, it's about grams of, you know, breaks down to protein and carbohydrate and other things. And I'm actually doing a food plan now, and, you know, if anybody, you know, I'm happy to chat food with anybody about anything. For most of the time, I've been doing 3 meals and 2 snacks, right? And that works well for me. And in some of those structured food plans, people would always say, you know, no, 3 meals a day, life in between. Oh, I just hate that. Like, really? I'm actually in my life when I'm eating my meals too, right? But it's the magic is not in the food plan. It's in a food plan and following it, right? For me. And, you know, some people, who knows? I mean, I have a girlfriend in OA. Her absence is no coffee Häagen-Dazs. Because she binges on coffee Häagen-Dazs. She doesn't binge on vanilla Häagen-Dazs. I mean, I've seen her. It's weird. But, you know, like coffee, she's like a fiend. It's crazy. But anyway, so, you know, figure it out. So a food plan doesn't necessarily just mean a weighed and measured. You know, a food plan is, well, I don't eat sugar, I don't eat whatever. My abstinence right now is I don't eat sugar or any of her evil stepsisters, right? I don't fool around with any kind of sugar, any sweets. I don't pretend that because I can't eat sugar, I can still eat sugarless stuff. I tried it for a long time, right? There's a candy company in Canada that is, I don't know who somebody made a deal with, but this is the best sugarless chocolate I've ever had in my life. It's insane how good this sugarless chocolate is. And I used to work in Canada. It was trouble, right? You don't know humiliation until you've run through an international airport with your hand between your legs because you've had too much sugarless chocolate and you don't want to shit in the middle of the airport, right? And I've done that. And then I'd eat it again, right? That's the insanity. That's the craziness, right? So I don't have any illusions that that stuff works. I don't do any of that stuff. I don't fool around. I don't chew gum. I don't drink diet soda. I've got a problem with something sweet on my palate. Why would I want to replicate that experience? You know, and the best thing is with great sugarless things, right? We always say, what's the thing we say when it's really great? It tastes like real stuff, right? Coke Zero or Coke 12, whatever it is, right? It tastes like the real stuff. Why would I want to do that? I've got a problem with sugar. Why would I want to do that? You know, when I was in Canada and I was going to OA meetings and I'd called a woman because I needed to find this OA meeting. And again, I've never talked to this woman in my life, right? So I'm just getting directions to the meeting and something, something. She must have heard me chewing gum and she said, oh, what, you know, are you eating? And I said, no. I said, I'm just chewing gum. Don't mind me. And I was a fiend of a gum chewer. I would buy packs of gum at Costco and I would chew them for like 2 minutes and then I'd take them out and put them on my bedpost, right? And then when you're all done with the gum, then you start chewing the gum based on, you know, what was the brightest color, right? Because you knew it had enough of the stuff left, right? That's what I used to do with my gum. I mean, thank God I never got lockjaw with chewing gum, right? And, you know, I mean, the jury is in on artificial sweeteners. I'm sorry, but they're carcinogenic. My husband's a scientist. It just is, right? But anyway, hang on. I'm not doing questions. I'm not done yet. So, I'm on the phone with this woman. She said, oh, really? You know, you're chewing gum, right? You chew a lot of gum? I said, yeah, I know I chew a lot of gum. I said, it's great, though. I said, it's not, you know, thank gosh, it's not sugar. You know, it's sugar-free gum, and it just works really well for me. She said, really? Does it? And I said, yeah. She said, because that seems unusual that you've got a problem with sugar, but you chew gum. And all I had done was called this woman to get directions to the meeting. Like, how did we get here? But I thought, well, I'm going to keep talking to her because I'm the educator, right? So I said, well, I said, actually, it does work for me, and it's not a problem. And she said, well, how does it work for you? And I said, well, I guess it keeps whatever at bay. I said, and, you know, the great thing is I like doing it. I kind of get that, you know, sweet thing. I get my sweet Jones out. And she said, it doesn't work for you? I said, it does work for me. I said, it does. I do fine with the gum. Because now I'm getting defensive, right? I do fine with the gum. I do fine with the gum. And it doesn't make me crazy the way sugar does. And there's a long pause. And she said, really? Because you sound pretty crazy to me. And I just felt like I'd been sucker punched. And she was absolutely right. Now, I didn't get off sugar with stuff till probably a year after that, right? But I never forgot her saying that. She was absolutely right. And I was too humiliated, right? Had no humility at all. I didn't even show up at the meeting, right, that she directed me to. Because it's like, right, like I'm going to show up for more of that. Right? Right? Thanks for sharing. But, you know, so I don't fool around with artificial sweeteners. I don't. I don't do honey. I don't do agave. I don't do any of that stuff. I got a problem with it. You know, I'll drink some fruit juice, right? I eat fruit. That's how I get my sweet Jones, right? I got a problem with it. Why would I do it? So I don't have any sugars. I don't do any flour at all. And I don't do any dairy. For me, dairy doesn't work for me. Dairy's a binge food. And, yeah. And then there are a myriad other little things. I don't do chips. I don't do popcorn. But somebody said, like, oh, you're a restrictor. I'm like, no, I'm actually not a restrictor. I'm actually not. I'm 24, almost 25 years here, and I know what works and what doesn't. I got a book that's got, like, the names and pictures of 300 different vegetables in it. I can eat any of them. I'm not a restrictor. But I know what works. I eat pretty simply.
Do you eat fruit?
I do eat fruit. I do. So that's what I do in terms of, you know, in terms of my abstinence. And, you know, there's the abstinence versus the food plan. I mean, sometimes I understand why people would leave OA to go to a structured food plan because it's, like, so complicated. It's like, wait, one minute, what's abstinence versus a food plan again? What? Explain that to me. Whatever. Anyway, so that's my thing. And then I weigh and measure. And that works for me. Yep. Anybody, you had a question.
I just wanted to know if you ate fruit.
Yes. Yes, I do. I do indeed. Now, I don't eat a lot of it, and I used to... You know, I used to really blow through things, you know, and I pay attention to the quantities that my RD has turned me on to. Like, a banana is actually two fruits. It's 30 grams of carbohydrate. So I didn't know that, right? So, you know, so things like that, I pay attention to those things. Because that can be a real problem, you know. I used to drink a lot of juice. And when I went into my first OA meeting, if I would have taken the direction I got from this first OA meeting I went into, and this woman said to me, I said, well, how does this abstinence thing work, right? I talked with her after the meeting, and she said, well, what's your problem? And I said, well, I think I've got a real problem with sugar. Plus, I weighed, you know, 200 pounds. And she said, well, what if you just didn't eat sugar and you ate three meals a day and you got a sponsor and you worked the steps and did that? What would you think about that? Think about that for abstinence. And I thought, okay. And it was 12 noon. I'd gone to an 11 a.m. meeting, and I was going to an OA meeting, so I figured, well, the way to lose weight is to not eat, right? That's actually not right. So it's 12 noon. I've been to an OA meeting. Now somebody just said to me, no sugar and three meals a day. So I go to a restaurant, and I order bacon and eggs and toast and a glass of orange juice. And literally in my life, I had never had that meal in front of me when it wasn't either involved in a binge or it wasn't at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I've, you know, we're done drinking, or we've just closed the bar, or whatever, right? And I didn't really do glasses of orange juice. I did quarts. So I'd never had that meal in front of me when it was a meal. And I ate that meal. I went out to my car, and I thought, wow. And I think there were two thoughts that went through my mind. The first one that went through said, I think I could actually do this. I think this could work. But that problem is that second thought. And the second thought was, no, it's got to be more complicated than this. And I proceeded to complicate it for the next 12 years, right? Coming up with good ideas. Having good ideas when they really weren't good at all, you know? And I wish I sometimes, you know, I just... Anyway, I don't spend a long time on it because that's, you know, that's a tunnel with no cheese.
I'm a diabetic, and if I drank juice like that, I'd be dead.
Absolutely. 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 So
And it's just by the grace of God, you know, that I don't have the diabetes stuff to deal with, you know. I mean, I've got my own autoimmune, so I'm right there with you, sister. I get it. So, yeah, that's the thing. That's why it's really important for me to pay attention in terms of sugar. And I've got a sponsor who's kind of trying to encourage me away from fruit and stuff. But, you know, she doesn't nose around too much because my RD is the one who runs the show. I go to a professional to have, you know, help me figure out what to eat. I don't want any good opinions from, you know, people in program. And when we're figuring out what weight I need to be at or whatever, I want to be tracking body fat and body mass and stuff. I want a professional in charge. I don't want to be making those decisions. Anything else before we take our break? All right, let's break for 10. All right. Okay, so we'll be back at 13 after. Thank you.